that music, Taryn. I always forget we're going to get the weird music when we do Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin, and it comes as such a nice surprise. Welcome back. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour, which is an awful good thing because this hour it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. Jimmy's senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and probably knows more about spoon bending than anyone else at Catholic Answers because that was the show today on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hi, Jimmy.
I probably do. And I've actually, the twist in the episode is, of today's episode of Mysterious World on spoon bending is that I've actually done it. I went to a spoon bending party recently and I was successful. And so what I tell you all about exactly what happened. And if you watch the video version or even just the episode art for the audio version, you get to see the spoon I bent. It's got a 180 degree turn in it.
Nice. All right.
It's 3 millimeters of stainless steel.
I'm going to have to listen to this on the way home tonight. So that'll be my drive home, listening to Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. You should listen to Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, too. I think he's, are we over 200 episodes now?
Oh, yeah. This is, today's episode is 227.
Nice. 227 episodes there for you. So,
and some bonus episodes as well.
Plus, that's just you, because you also wrote a book, 300, A Daily Defense, 365 Days, plus one to becoming a better apologist. You're always giving that a little extra effort there, Jimmy.
I try to do that, yeah.
That was probably why people like the shows and the books and all that stuff. All right, so weird questions people should know is they're all sent to us via the internets. Jimmy collects them for us, and then I ask them of Jimmy. And he answers them. And part of the reason
that's
we started...
That's usually how question asking and answering works. Yeah.
But part of the reason we started not doing this show live is that you really get weirder questions if you let people write them and send them in. I mean, sometimes people will ask a question that's not weird at all, and it kind of breaks the whole premise. So I can guarantee you we got some weird questions for you.
Yeah, there's a difference between weird and obscure.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I'm going to start with a question from Kat. Kat asks, can St. Padre Pio still give absolution?
So St. Padre Pio is a saint, so he's in heaven, which means he's dead. And the short and safe answer to the question would be that the sacraments require a priest to be alive to administer the sacraments. However, there is reason to think about that a little more deeply, because being ordained to the priesthood makes a permanent mark on your soul. So priests are still priests in the afterlife, just like baptism makes a permanent mark on your soul. So you're still a baptized person even in the afterlife. And so if the graces of baptism follow us with the mark, then the graces of being a priest should also follow the priest into the afterlife as well. And one of those graces is the ability to confect the sacraments. And so, hypothetically, it would seem to at least be conceptually possible that a priest in the afterlife could administer the sacraments if he were in a position to do so, you know, like if God allowed him to manifest to the living and the living could then confess to him. There are even reports in the literature of approved private revelations of some extraordinary things happening with sacraments. Like, for example, the children at Fatima reported that an angel brought Holy Communion to them, and they received Holy Communion from the hands of an angel. Also, Padre Pio himself, and I talked about this in an episode of Mysterious World I did a little while ago on Padre Pio. It was the episode on bilocation, and in talking about Padre Pio's bilocation experiences, he reported that even though he was physically in his monastery, he bilocated to St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. And while he was bilocating to St. Peter's Basilica, a young woman came to him for confession, and he heard her confession and absolved her through the bilocation, and then he later met her in person. and they had both shared this same experience. So there are reports of extraordinary sacramental experiences. And so the answer to the question is more interesting and more ambiguous than it might appear. I mean, the simple thing is to say no.
Right.
But when you look at the history of these things, there's more possibility there. So if Padre Pio appeared to me in an authentic vision and absolved me, I would be inclined to regard it as at least an indication that I was in a state of grace afterwards.
Kat, thank you. Now, see, that is a good weird question. Absolution after death. That's a good weird question. That fits the category perfectly.
Absolution of a living person.
Oh, yeah.
After the death of the absolver.
Right. Jimmy Akin's our guest. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin, and we got time for more. We got another question before we have to go to break, at least one more. Kaylin asked this, Jimmy. If a faithful Catholic couple who are not yet married but want to be were able to find each other or happen to already be spending time together during a cyber attack or catastrophic natural disaster that ended modern society as we know it, how would they go about getting married? If they had no way to find a priest, would they just have to wander around the wasteland until they found one? Or could they make their vows in the presence of whatever witnesses they could find?
So this is something, not this exact scenario, but the principle that answers the question is actually dealt with in canon law. It's in canon 1116, so 1116, and it says this: if a person competent to assist according to the norm of law, meaning assisted a marriage, so that would be a priest, and specifically your pastor, unless it's someone else that's received approval. If a person competent to assist according to the norm of law cannot be present or approached without grave inconvenience, so that's a key term, grave inconvenience, like might be caused by a civilization-ending disaster.
Often very inconvenient.
Those who intend to enter into a true marriage can contract it validly and licitly before witnesses only, one, in danger of death, or two, when danger of death might be present in a civilization-ending disaster, or two, outside of the danger of death, provided that it is prudently foreseen that the situation will continue for a month. So if you have a civilization-ending disaster and you prudently foresee that you're not going to be able to find your pastor or another approved priest for a month, you and your betrothed can get married just in front of whatever witnesses you can find.
That it really eases my mind, because in a civilization-ending disaster, I don't know. It'd be very
hard. And that's the time you really need to get hitched, because if there's been a civilization-ending disaster, we need to start having babies fast.
Yes, stat. We need some families. All right. So, Kaylin, I'm very appreciative of the question. Thank you very much for sending it. We got a whole bunch more weird questions for Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Starting to talk again. But
underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
I did not grow up religious. This morning, as I was chaotically driving around looking for a COVID testing site, I actually saw your radio station on somebody's car in front of me. Something told me to listen up, and so I switched up to the station and just started listening. And now here I am on the phone talking to you guys.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live.
That cool music means it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour. I just mentioned to Jimmy during the break, and I'll mention to you so you can keep them in your prayers, that Darren is a bit distracted at the soundboard because child number five looks like he or she may want to come today or tomorrow. So he's got a lot on his mind. A prayer for Darren and Rena and for their family would be very, very welcome.
It's such a great thing, especially after the last question, just in case we have a civilization-ending disaster.
I know.
But babies at any time are awesome.
The next question comes from Shane. Shane asks, in Psalm 139 in the New American Bible, it says, if I ascend to the heavens, you are there. If I lie down in Sheol...
Hey, you said it right.
I was hoping I got that right.
I was going to correct you if you didn't. It is not Sheol. It's Sheol. Good.
Well, thank you. I learned. If I lie down in Sheol, you are there too. So what exactly is Sheol?
Sheol is a Hebrew word that is used in connection with the afterlife. The way that ancient Israelites envisioned what happened in the afterlife, and of course this was before Jesus opened the gates of heaven, but the way they envisioned it is when you died, your soul descended to a place called Sheol. And there are some Bible translations that... will translate the Hebrew word Sheol with the English term grave, but that's not really a great translation, in part because ancient Israelites often didn't dig graves that you would lower someone into. They often buried, there are lots of caves in Israel, and they'd very frequently bury people in caves. I mean, like we see that with Jesus in a tomb that he goes into horizontally. Same thing for Lazarus. Same thing for Abraham and Sarah. They're buried in a cave. So were Israel himself, the patriarch Jacob, and his son Joseph. In fact, Israel and Jacob are unique in part of the way they got buried. Not everybody knows this, but if you read Genesis, they both died in Egypt. So, Sykelet, what is the most, and they were prestigious, you know, because Joseph was basically the prime minister of Egypt and Jacob was his father. So they were very prestigious. What's the prestigious way to get buried in Egypt? And I don't mean in a pyramid because that's old. That's
not
so
what
old
happened.
Kingdom.
Old kingdom.
Yeah. What happens with your body when you die and they're getting you ready in Egypt?
Let me ask my mummy. She might know.
Yeah. they mummify you. And actually, Jacob, the patriarch Israel himself, and Joseph were mummified. And it talks about that in Genesis. It mentions, in fact, now the way they mummified you in Egypt was the first thing they would do, well, they'd take out all your organs and stuff. And since this is a Weird Question show, I'll even mention how they got the brain out. A lot of people know, because little boys love to know this because it's a little gross, but the way they got your brain out was they took it out through the nose. And Egyptologists wondered for a long time exactly how did they get it out. And what they assumed, because they had found these implements, and I will get back to Sheol, but this is just cool. So they found these coat hanger-like implements that were involved in the process, and they had images on tomb walls of these being used, or papyrus images of them being used, where they would insert the rod. It's kind of like a coat hanger with a hook on the end of it. They'd insert that through your nose and go through the ethmoid bone to get into the brain. And then the Egyptologists assumed they would bring out the brain piece by piece. Well, in the late 20th century, an Egyptologist named Bob Breyer, who I'm going to be having on Mysterious World to talk about mummies, actually did an archaeological experiment where they used someone had donated their body to science, and they mummified it to figure out how did this exactly work. And they found out that there's no way you can get the brain out a piece at a time through the nose. It's like tofu. The hook just goes right through it. And so what they finally figured out they had to do was lay the mummy on its back, stick in the implement, swish it around to liquefy the brain, and then flip the mummy on its stomach so that the brain would drain out the nose. So that's exactly the kind of thing little boys love to know about. So for all the little boys in the audience, you're welcome.
You're welcome right now.
in any event, they would, after they did all that, they would pack you in natron, which is a substance that occurs naturally in Egypt. It's essentially a combination of baking soda and table salt in chemical terms, and it would dry you out, and they put you in the natron for 30 days, and then you still had enough moisture in you to that they could like pose your body and like cross your hands over your chest and stuff, and then they would complete the process. The whole thing took 70 days. Well, in ancient Israel, so here's the connection back to the Bible, in ancient Israel, they didn't embalm people. They buried them the same day.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, the person dies, put them in the tomb, come back in a year when their flesh has decomposed and clean their bones and put them in a bone box in an ossuary. Well, for the benefit of the readers of Genesis, the author explains when he says that they embalmed or mummified Jacob, Israel himself, that the whole process took 70 days. And to an ancient Israelite, which is what our records from Egypt confirm, you had to bury the body on the 70th day after death. And so our Egyptological records confirm what it says in Genesis. But because the idea of embalming, you know, embalming was not used in ancient Israel, 70 days, that would be mind-blowing.
Yeah.
You know, why would it take 70 days? And so the author of Genesis adds the comment to get the Israelite reader over that conceptual hurdle, because that's how long it takes to embalm someone in the Egyptian way. So actually both Jacob and Joseph were mummified, and then at the time of the Exodus they brought their mummies with them back to Egypt and also buried them in caves. And so they were buried horizontally. They didn't descend. Like a lot of other people didn't descend. They weren't lowered into graves. They were put into graves sideways. And that's one reason why grave is not a good translation of Sheol. It's really a term for the place of the dead in the afterlife, which is conceptualized as being below ground. And we see a parallel instance of that in 1 Samuel, where now one of the requirements in Deuteronomy is you don't consult an inquirer of the dead, or what today we would call a medium. You don't get your oracles that way. You go to a prophet for your oracle. Well, King Saul in 1 Samuel is having, I want to say it's 1 Samuel 28, is having a bit of a crisis because he's in a dangerous battle situation, and he needs to ask a question of the Lord, but the Lord is not picking up the phone. He is not answering by prophets or by dreams or by Urim and Thummim. And so what's the only, if God's not going to answer him, how's he going to get the information he wants? And what he decides to do, even though he himself has previously commanded that all the inquirers of the dead, all the mediums be expelled from Israel, he says, find me one. And so his men happen to know that there is a medium at the town of Endor. And this is the basis. This is the so-called Witch of Endor, which is not a good translation. But this is the Witch of Endor, who's the basis of the character in Dora from the TV show Bewitched. So he goes to the Witch of Endor, let's call her Endora just for fun. And she says, who do you want me to bring up for you? And he says, Samuel. And so Samuel's ghost then emerges from the ground, and Saul gets to ask his question. And Samuel's message is, first thing Samuel says is, why have you disturbed me? So it's like, I was down there, I was at peace in Sheol, and now you've brought me up. Why are you bugging me? And Saul says, well, I have this battle question I need to ask you. And so he does. And Samuel says, well, guess what? You're doomed. and he goes back down.
Good night.
Yeah. But you see how, again, they're conceptualizing Sheol as being the place of the dead, as being below ground. And that also carried over into the New Testament era. When you read in the New Testament, the word that the Greek word that is used for the place of the dead is Hades, from which we get in English Hades. Hades is not the place of the damned. It's where the dead in general go. And it was also a place in the Greek mind that you descended to. And so Sheol is simply a Hebrew term that's used for the place of the dead in the afterlife. And it's equivalent to Hades or Hades as well. But the situation has now changed because as a result of the crucifixion and resurrection of Christ, heaven is now opened to those who die in God's friendship. And so saints tend to go up rather than down, at least conceptually.
Very, very good. I'm very grateful for that question because sometimes the discourses are more just as much fun as the answer to the question. So thanks, Shane. I will try not to dream about the brain thing tonight. But
well, at least you can rest confident that there are biblical mummies.
Yes, right. Exactly.
Bible mummies.
Next one comes from Jordan. Yes, next one comes from Jordan. I heard a priest created a machine allowing him to see the events of the crucifixion as they happened. Then the Vatican excommunicated him. Is this a true-ish story?
No. This is not this is not true. It's not even true-ish.
Okay.
Although I have seen the theme explored elsewhere. Well, my favorite comic book series is the Legion of Superheroes, which is set in the 31st century. And by the 31st century, they have time travel. And so there's one issue, and actually the author of this issue happened to be Jewish, but there's this one issue where you're at the 31st century Time Institute, and they're talking about what they should do with their time viewer. And one of the scientists, who's an alien, I mean, he doesn't even look human, is talking to one of the human scientists and says, "We could finally solve the great mystery of AD 33.
Oh.
and I love this alien saying, "Let's use the time viewer to watch the crucifixion and resurrection." I just think that's awesome.
Right, yeah. So, but this priest was not excommunicated, or he didn't invent the machine?
Both.
Okay.
And also he didn't exist.
Okay. That's three strikes against him, Jordan. I hope you're satisfied with that answer. The next question comes from Mary Rose. It's kind of a two-parter.
She has two. We can probably do at least the first before the break.
Okay, then let's do question one from Mary Rose. Speaking in tongues and resting in the spirit, are they always legit or are they sometimes psychological?
Okay, so we should probably define them first, just for people who might not be familiar. Speaking in tongues is a phenomenon that has been reported ever since biblical days. It's also reported in other cultures, but it is reported beginning in the book of Acts as something that happened on the day of Pentecost, and it's been reported periodically down through church history. It has not always been understood the same way. If you look at the biblical evidence, it seems that the biblical form of speaking in tongues is speaking in a language that you don't naturally know. That's what the word tongue means. It can either mean in Greek, tongue, glossa, can either refer to the thing in your mouth, or it can refer to the language that you speak using the thing in your mouth. And even sometimes today, we'll talk about the English tongue or the French tongue or the German tongue to refer to those different languages. Well, that was the normal way to refer to languages back then. And so if you're speaking in other tongues, the natural way to understand that is speaking in other languages. And that's consistent with what we see, if you study the text carefully, with what we see both in Acts and in 1 Corinthians and so forth in the New Testament. Resting in the spirit is a modern spiritual phenomenon that has not, at least to my knowledge, been reported throughout church history. It used to be called being slain in the spirit, and it was something that was popularized in the 20th century in the Pentecostal and charismatic movements outside the Catholic Church and sometimes inside the Catholic Church, where someone would go to a Pentecostal or charismatic gathering and they would be so overcome by the Holy Spirit that they would faint. And you would even see, you can see videos of people going to such revivals, and the minister will be walking up to people and touching them on the forehead and they just keel over. And originally this was called being slain in the spirit, because you fall down as if you've been killed, but you really haven't been killed. And so these days the terminology has shifted and it's more often called resting in the spirit. But that's basically what it is. It's an overpowering experience that kind of knocks you out or causes you to fall over. As to whether they're always legit or sometimes psychological, here's our cliffhanger.
We will be right back to solve that cliffhanger and get more weird questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
The recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade was a monumental victory for the pro-life movement. But the fight is far from over. With our new booklet, Why We're Pro-Life, we have produced the perfect tool to prepare you to have peaceful and convincing conversations to shed light on the truth about human life from conception to natural death. Catholic Answers is printing millions of copies of this booklet, and we plan simply to give them away. You can help us in two ways. First, by generously supporting this project. 25 cents prints one book. $2,500 prints 10,000, and so on. Second, by helping us distribute the booklet through your parish, your school, or the pro-life ministry you work with. Catholic Answers is going to blanket the country with Why We're Pro-Life, but only if you step up and help us. Thank you so much. For more information, visit whyweareprolife.com.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Matt Swaim here. Monday on the Sunrise Morning Show, we'll celebrate the Feast of St. Daniel Comboni, founder of the Comboni Missionaries. Plus news, weather, sports, and more. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Weird questions with Jimmy Akin this hour on Catholic Answers Live. And Mary Rose asked Jimmy if speaking in tongues and resting in the spirit are always legit, or are they sometimes psychological? We left you with a little cliffhanger. Are they always legit, or are they sometimes psychological?
Well, like anything preternatural things, including the paranormal and also the supernatural. Anything preternatural is like anything natural. It's not always one thing or always the other. I mean, sometimes when you're out in the desert and you're looking down the road, you see water in the road, and sometimes it's water and sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's an illusion caused by the heat.
Yeah.
So we would and the same thing is true with other phenomena. Sometimes you're looking at the genuine phenomenon, and sometimes you're not. Sometimes it's just something that looks like it or is similar to it in some ways. So when it comes to things like speaking in tongues or resting in the spirit, I'm sure that sometimes speaking in tongues is real because it's reported in the Bible. Resting in the spirit is not reported in the Bible, but as the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith pointed out a few years ago, the lists of charismatic phenomena in Scripture are not exhaustive, and they're also not frozen. God can give different gifts in different ages. So could someone have an experience of the Holy Spirit that's so powerful that they faint or otherwise go limp? Sure, I don't see why not. You know, the Holy Spirit can affect people subtly or very powerfully, and I don't see why that's not an unreasonable thing to have happen at least some of the time. So I would think some of the time, both speaking in tongues and resting in the Spirit are going to be legitimate, but a lot of people also want to have spiritual manifestations of an extraordinary nature. And that can result in a lot of people out of innocently, you know, but just out of a genuine desire to experience things like this. It can lead them to convince themselves that that's what's happening when really that's not what's happening. And so Some of the times I think that speaking in tongues and resting in the Spirit are going to be psychological and not actually authentic.
Mary Rose, thank you for that question. Shall we do number two?
Let's do number two.
All right, this also comes...
There ain't no number three.
All right. Mary Rose asks this. Mystics who claim to live without food for years. There are a few in the Catholic tradition, but there are also claims of Prahlad Jani, an Indian Hindu. Is it demonic or a hoax?
Well, again, I don't know that it should be. I don't think we're limited to those two options. As Mary Rose mentions, there are reports in Catholic tradition of people who are spiritual being able to live for extended periods of time, either completely without food and water or at least without as much as should be expected to survive. And so there are instances of extraordinary fasting. Now, one of the names for this phenomenon is inedia. And you can hear how edia sounds like edible. And of course, in means not. Like if someone is inhospitable, it means they're not hospitable. So inedia means not eating. And this phenomenon is sometimes called inedia. Indian mystic Prahlad Jani claimed to go for 2 weeks without eating anything or drinking anything, if I recall correctly. And he even would submit himself for testing sometimes. They like had him in a hospital and were monitoring him over in India. But the tests were widely criticized by skeptics in India who pointed out a number of things. One is they kept some of the results confidential of the testing they did of him, you know, because they would run blood tests and stuff. Also, they would do testing out of sight, and they would let him out of his room so he wasn't constantly being monitored on camera. They would let him go sunbathing. They would let him bathe. They would, without a camera on him, they would let him gargle. And there are ways he could get, now in terms of food, a 2 week fast, that's nothing. That's not going to kill you. Not for a person who has good health. You can easily go 2 weeks without food. It may not be comfortable the first few days, but you can do that. And I've had enough experience with intermittent fasting that, and done enough reading on intermittent fasting. Yeah, 2 weeks without food, that's not a big deal. What's a little harder is 2 weeks without fluid, you know, without water. But if they're letting you gargle and they're letting you bathe and they're letting you do other things off camera, you don't have actual proof that anything is happening here. This could easily be a hoax. And there have certainly been a lot of hoaxes in this area. There's an entire sect known as, they're kind of New Age sect, but they're known as the Breatharians. And they claim that you don't actually need to eat, that you can get all the nutrients you need just by breathing if you're spiritual enough. And what they have regularly found is that the Breatharian leaders who are making these claims are secretly chowing down. So they're this technique, at least normally, does not work. And so I would say in a lot of these cases, it's simply a hoax. As to when it might be genuine, I would recommend a particular book. Back in the first half of the 20th century, there was a Catholic parapsychologist whose name was Father Herbert Thurston. He's one of several Catholic parapsychologists from the 20th century. And one of the books that he wrote is called The Physical Phenomena of Mysticism. And so if you look up The Physical Phenomena of Mysticism by Father Herbert Thurston, he has a whole chapter in it on inedia. And so you can read about what he has to say and get his evaluation of these various cases that are reported, for example, in the Christian tradition. As far as the idea that Mary Rose mentions of this being demonic, well, I couldn't rule out that a demon would do it, but I also have no evidence that a demon is involved in any of these cases. People should not simply assume that everything mysterious is due to demons, because it's not. There's lots of mysterious stuff that is not due to demons. And if you're doing a parapsychological investigation of a situation, natural phenomena are more common than preternatural phenomena. And so if you have a natural explanation for what has been observed, it is more likely than a preternatural explanation. And given the experience with Breatharians and hoaxes and doing fasts within the normal tolerance of what the human body can handle, I would point to those natural explanations of, yeah, this fast isn't particularly impressive, or this is just a hoax, as being more likely in doubtful cases. I would need additional things in the case in order to be able to propose a demonic explanation, like the person is genuinely doing preternatural things and cannot bear to look at a crucifix. Bear to have the Hail Mary said in their presence. So, you know, aversions to holy items and actions is something that you would need in order to say, yeah, this is a demon, rather than this person is just good at fasting or they're cheating.
Mary Rose, thank you for a couple of very good questions, very appropriate for Jimmy. Well, weird questions. I almost said Jimmy Akin's Weird World, but mixing things up. Weird questions with Jimmy Akin.
Pauline Dakin has the Weird World.
Oh, there is a thing called The Weird World? Oh, I know what you're talking about. Oh, I forgot. Yeah. Actually an episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
It's not Jimmy Akin's Weird World, but Pauline Dakin and The Weird World.
And The Weird World,
it's weird.
You got to listen to the episode. At a certain point, it was one of my favorite episodes of Jimmy Akin's where I just went, what? We better take a break. Let's take a quick break, and we'll do more weird questions with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The most original Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
What have you always wanted to know about the Vatican? Well, I'm your Vatican Insider, and I answer that question when I bring you the news about the Pope, Vatican City, and I share insights and stories from a broad spectrum of church ministries.
Vatican Insider with Joan Lewis, Saturday night, 9 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Theremin, right? That's the theremin. We asked for theremin. We got theremin. The composers of the music for Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World gave us some theremin in there. Because if you're going to have a, no, not Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. I'm sorry. But if you're going to do Weird Questions, you need a theremin. I mean, that is the weird instrument. This one comes from Paul. This weird question comes from Paul. What is your opinion on the concept of limbo as the eternal home of the souls of unbaptized babies?
I'm skeptical of it. So the idea is that this was, limbo was a theological speculation. It still is a theological speculation that's meant to answer the question of what would happen if a baby who has no personal sin but who has not been baptized were to die. And obviously that happened a lot in history when infant mortality was very high. And the reasoning was, well, you need to be baptized in order to have sanctifying grace, and you need sanctifying grace to be in spiritual union with God and go to heaven. So if these babies are not baptized, then they wouldn't have the grace needed to be with God and they wouldn't go to heaven. On the other hand, they haven't committed any personal sins, so they shouldn't suffer. You know, it's because they're not able at that age to commit personal sin, and certainly not mortal sin. So they shouldn't suffer in the afterlife either. And so the idea was proposed that they went to the fringe, and in Latin, fringe is limbus. They went to the limbus or fringe of hell, where they weren't in heaven, but they also really wouldn't be suffering. And they would just stay there for all eternity. And some, like St. Augustine, speculated maybe they'll, because they're on the fringe of hell, maybe they'll suffer a little bit, but only the lightest of sufferings. And later theologians said, you know, they really shouldn't suffer at all. Mm-hmm. And maybe even they will have great natural happiness in limbo. They just won't have the supernatural happiness of being united with God and having the beatific vision. But you don't have to have the beatific vision to have a lot of natural happiness. I mean, go to an amusement park, ride a roller coaster, you know, pick out on the weird food stands, have some, you know, deep fried ice cream or deep fried chili poppers or something. You can have lots of fun without being in heaven. So maybe the children who went to this state would have lots of natural happiness, just not the full supernatural happiness of heaven. Well, so that's one possible way of explaining what would happen to these children. And for a time, it was the favored explanation, favored to the point that it became part of the common teaching of the church. So it wasn't simply a matter of theology. It was a kind of low-level doctrine, but not an infallible one. And with further doctrinal development, notably in the 20th century, although there are precedents prior to the 20th century for this, you will find individuals in prior centuries saying, you know, I think God could do it another way too. By the time of the Second Vatican Council, the Magisterium had reached a point where they said God gives everybody the opportunity for becoming associated with the saving grace of Christ, even if it's in a way that we can't perceive or understand in this life, in ways known to him, he does this. And if he does that for everybody, that's going to include unbaptized babies. And so by the time the Catechism of the Catholic Church came out in 1992, it said that we may entrust the salvation of these infants to God. We're not really told what happens to them, but we can prayerfully entrust them to God's care and hope that he has ways of salvation, of providing salvation for them, in which case they wouldn't need to go to limbo. And then in 2007, under Pope Benedict, an advisory body known as the International Theological Commission published a paper that the Vatican had commissioned them to write, called The Hope of Salvation for Infants Who Die Without Being Baptized. And Pope Benedict encouraged them to examine this subject and see, are there other ways besides limbo that this could work? And they looked at it and they concluded, yeah, there are. It could be that God counts and they weren't equally favorable on all of these options, but they said, and others have said, that the uh, that, you know, God might count the desire of the parents for the child's salvation as a kind of proxy baptism of desire, or the desire of the church for their salvation as a kind of proxy for baptism that would allow them to receive grace. And so the International Theological Commission concluded that that limbo is still a valid speculation as far as what happens, but it's only a speculation, and there are other good speculations as well. And personally, I tend to favor the other speculations. I think I'm personally quite skeptical of limbo. I think God can provide salvation for unbaptized children, just like he can provide salvation for other unbaptized people.
Paul, thank you very, very much. Appreciate that question. This one comes from Joshua. Joshua asks, if they were still around, which human relatives, Homo Neanderthalis, Homo erectus, Homo florentiensis, Homo Denisova, etc., would we likely be able to baptize if they were so inclined to be received by Christ and his church?
Okay, so I guess I need to kind of partition this question. When Joshua says, if they were so inclined, I assume he's talking about the members of these other early human groups. And if they're so inclined, I would say baptize them.
What you're saying, yeah.
If you got a volunteer for baptism, they want to be baptized, baptize them. That the fact that they're able to request the baptism, understanding what it means, indicates to me that they are a suitable candidate for baptism. So they, if they know about, okay, there's God, his son, Jesus Christ, there's an afterlife, you want to be with him in heaven, in the afterlife, they got all that conceptual package and they say, sign me up. Well, then sign them up, baptize them. You don't really need to worry about it beyond that. However, if we're asking the question in the abstract, which are most likely to be able to benefit from baptism, then I'd need to approach the question differently and say, well, what evidence do we have concerning them? Because a standard principle that I use is, if someone has the concept of God, or if they have the concept of the afterlife, then that's a good sign that they have a soul that will survive into the afterlife. Now, I've actually done more research on this. You know, the common theological opinion, this is not church teaching, but the common theological opinion is that you need a rational soul in order to survive death. And rational meaning human level reason. Well, okay, that's based on philosophical arguments. And I actually did an episode of Mysterious World where I reviewed those philosophical arguments. It's episode 203, so people could find it by going to mysterious.fm/203. if they want. But I look at those arguments and I don't think they're conclusive at all. I don't think they're persuasive. And we've got some evidence that animals may survive into the afterlife, including empirical evidence that they may survive into the afterlife, or at least that some of them may. And if you want to hear about that, go listen to episode 203 of Mysterious World, because I don't want to take time away from our question here. So of these, assuming you need a rational soul to experience the afterlife, which of these most likely have that? Well, the one that would most likely not have it is Homo erectus. Homo erectus means upright man, because he walked upright. That's the oldest of these groups. And so if any of them lacked a rational soul, it would be Homo erectus. When it comes to Homo neanderthalensis, I would say that based on current archaeological findings, they are extremely likely to have rational souls. We have evidence that they not only buried their dead, and that's a noteworthy sign, but it's not proof to my mind, of them having the concept of the afterlife, because dead bodies stink. You know, it's like Martha said at Lazarus's tomb, Lord, behold, it's the fourth day. He stinketh. I mean,
she said stinketh, huh?
Well, yeah.
Very King James,
in essence,
of her.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you could bury the dead simply for hygienic reasons, you know, like cats bury their own poop, not because they have any philosophical ideas about it, just because they have a disgust reaction and a reflex to bury it. So Neanderthals and others could have buried their dead without the concept of the afterlife. But it looks like Neanderthals also put in grave goods. Grave goods are items that you bury with the dead, and there may be a literal belief that the dead will use this item in the afterlife, or it may just kind of be a symbolic gesture of, you know, so-and-so really loved this thing, and so I want them to have it in the afterlife, even if this is just a symbol and they're not really going to use it. Although sometimes they did literally believe it. In Egypt, for example, they would bury – the reason that they would bury stuff with you was so that you could use it in the afterlife. You know, they would put food and oils and stuff like that in tombs so that the mummies, when they wake up in their version of the resurrection, they can use this stuff. But in other cases, it's just a symbolic gesture of my child died and this was my child's favorite toy, and so I'm going to bury the toy with the child as a grave good so that symbolically, at least, the child will have the toy that they really liked in the afterlife. Well, it looks like Neanderthals buried grave goods. And that suggests they had, whether they interpreted the use of the grave good literally or non-literally, that suggests they had the concept of the afterlife. And if you've got the concept of the afterlife, I think you've got an afterlife for sure. When it comes to Homo floresiensis, so they're very recently discovered, and we only have a few instances. They're found in the Dutch East Indies. Or the East Indies, and they're the hobbit race. They're shorter in stature. They're kind of like pygmies, but we have very little of their culture, and I don't know that we found grave goods for them. Same thing with the Denisovans. They were from, they kind of lived in the modern Russian Federation, and we only have a few instances of them. They're also recently discovered. They're not as well studied as Neanderthals. I think the evidence would point to the Neanderthals definitely having an afterlife, and I would suspect that the others do too. So since we're taking the question of, are they inclined to be baptized out of it? If someone gave me a Neanderthal baby or a Homo floresiensis baby, or a Homo Denisovan baby, or a Homo erectus baby, my inclination would be to baptize all of them and said, here, you can raise this. My inclination would be to baptize all of them conditionally and then do my best to raise them in the Catholic faith.
Very, very interesting. Joshua, I'm so glad you asked the question. But I have to ask you, Jimmy, because I don't understand this. I don't understand how Neanderthalensis is a different species from us, because we clearly could
breed with them. We did.
Yeah.
So we had really attractive ancestors, and other groups wanted to breed with them, and they did.
So how are they a different species?
Well, so the term species is somewhat flexible in biology. It can be used for two different populations that cannot breed with each other and produce fertile offspring. But the problem is there are exceptions. Like, we don't consider horses and donkeys the same species, but they can interbreed to an extent. Similarly, lions and tigers, we'd consider them different, but they can interbreed to a certain extent. So there's some flexibility about exactly what counts as the same species. It's fair to say that these relatives of ours that belong to Homo are human because they belong to Homo, but they may be a different subspecies than we are.
I love Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. I love the music. I'm glad we did it. Jimmy, thanks very much for another great hour.
My pleasure.
And that'll do it for us. I want to remind you that the fall sale is on over at shop.catholic.com. Every single thing on sale, some of it at astonishingly low prices. Shop.catholic.com. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.